The man they found at base camp was frozen solid. His hair was matted, his hands were green. The smell alone had the men acting as a rescue squad, trying to move as far away as they could. Higher on the mountain, they found two more. They were also frozen, solid, one leg tucked under and the other extended, as if they were bracing against something. Was it the wind? Were they holding onto a rope in a tug of war for their lives? Were they trying to help others as they worked their way down from the peak? These three men that were found had already perished, yet there were four others that still needed accounted for. Little is known about what they experienced on the highest peak in North America when the storm of a century hit while they were standing 4 miles above sea level. But it can be determined that these men knew, whether they dug in to wait it out or immediately tried to leave the top, that if they stayed, they would die. And so their only hope for survival was to go out in the most brutal storm ever to hit Mount Denali. Maybe they just froze. Maybe the snow covered them and gave them their final resting place. Maybe an avalanche swept them up and took them to a lower elevation. Maybe the winds, raging at upwards of 300 miles an hour, blew them into a crevice or off the side of a sheer cliff. Maybe their death was peaceful. After all, they say freezing to death isn't so bad. But what about the survivors? The ones who had been there just the day before, and those who stepped into the role of search and rescue when they themselves were just trying to survive. Welcome back to Tragedy with a View. And today I have my friend Lexi with me, and I'm sure she'll have thoughts at some point.
I hope so. Present.
Present. Yeah.
Don't forget Denali.
Denali. Oh gosh, I did it. Okay. Apparently, I just learned today that Denali, as I've been saying it for my entire knowledge of the national park and the mountain, is actually Denali. So like Den Alley, not Den Ali, which doesn't sound super different, but it's enough. And I learned that because I listened to an interview with Andy Hall, who wrote the book Denali's Howl, which is where I got like 99% of this information came from. Denali's Howl.
It's a tough one.
I'm sure I'll interchange it throughout. But yeah, so he was referring to it as Denali, which he, if you read the book or if you want to just hear it here, he was a child when this event happened, and his father was the superintendent of the park at the time. So he has lived in this park and been a part of this process. And so when he says Denali, I'm going to believe that that's how it's supposed to be pronounced. A very quick note, because I've mentioned it a couple of times in previous episodes, that I was going to be working on Patreon exclusive releases in 2024. And I am going to hold off on giving a hard date to that because I've got some other things happening that I don't want to get so busy that I can't give that content anymore. And then, you know, I don't want to start something and then take it away because I'm too busy.
What's so, a Patreon exclusive?
Patreon is a hosting platform where people can pay $4 a month to get exclusive content. So like you can go to Spotify and you get all of the episodes except for the Patreon exclusives, which if you're then a Patreon member, it connects in with Spotify and you can get them all right there on Spotify. But if you're not a Patreon member, then you don't have access to those exclusive episodes. Hmm. So it was an avenue that I was exploring the last few months, and I'm going to hold off on that. But on the plus side, the couple episodes that I had already planned for Patreon is going to be free and available to everyone else. And they're really, really good stories. They're like some of my favorites, which is saying something because they're also very morbid. Very morbid. But yeah, so you'll get those later at a later date, and I'll revisit the Patreon. Also, before we get in really deep on this, I want to give you a heads up that there are a lot of people involved here. There's a lot of names. there's several people who have the same name, and everyone's kind of interacting with each other and separately from each other, and so it does get very confusing. I'm going to try to be as clear as I can when introducing people, like who they are, what groups they're a part of, what their jobs were in this incident. But if you at some point feel like you're not keeping track of like who's this person or what this person does or XYZ, I also had the same experience. And it was like once I started like really writing things down was when I was like, oh, okay, I know like who's who now. I'm not expecting anyone to be writing things down. So.
Well, I'll help out here.
Yeah.
I'll ask. Yeah. I get confused easily, so.
If there's any questions, feel free. So we are going back to 1967, where Joe Wilcox and 11 other men scaled Mount Denali, or Mount McKinley at the time. To the tribes around the mountain, the name was once Denahit. Hold on.
Denahit.
Denahit. Deraleka, or Denali. And these roughly translated into the big one, the great one, the high one, the big mountain, etc. The name McKinley was given in 1897 when a news reporter wrote an article referring to the mountain as Mount McKinley in reference to William McKinley, who had just been nominated for president. And 4 years later, when he was assassinated, the name just kind of stuck to the mountain. And then in 2015, under President Obama's guide, the park and the mountain began to regain the original Denali name. Denali is known to have some of the most perilous weather conditions and terrain. Snow falls on the mountain most of the year, and the upper part of the mountain actually has snow all year round. If you are intending to climb the mountain, these men were climbing the mountain in July, there's snow. You are going to experience snow no matter when you go onto the mountain. They also have multiple glaciers and ice river and granite walls that ice sheets will just fall off of.
This particular mountain comes with more hazards than
yes,
some others.
It does. It's actually been said that it makes its own weather. And the mountain itself is so big that they've had on like one side of the mountain, they'll have like reports of like rain, sun, rain. And then on the other side of the mountain, they're getting like blizzard force winds and snow, complete whiteout. They can't see a thing. And then you go to a different part of the mountain and they're getting a different weather report. So it's very inconsistent.
Do we know how big this mountain is?
I did not look up like square footage, but on land, I'm skipping ahead here. So I'm going to be saying a whole lot later when I'm like, I already said all this. It is the largest from base to peak in the world.
In the world?
In the world. So Everest extends higher into the atmosphere, but the base also starts higher.
Ooh.
So you're not climbing as far as you are on Denali, which sits lower than Everest height-wise, but their base also starts way lower. The only mountain that's larger is in Hawaii. Since the 1990s, men have strived to reach its peak, and it was finally conquered in 1913. The coldest month of the year, temperatures at the summit average negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 35 degrees Celsius. Denali is no small feat, with 42% less oxygen than at sea level, and with its close proximity to the troposphere and the right atmospheric conditions in this area, it pushes the jet stream lower, which often brings winds of over 100 miles per hour, even on sunshine days. A note about the atmosphere, around the equator, the atmosphere is thickest. It's like, it almost like bulges, like instead of just being like a perfect circle around the Earth, it like becomes like oblong around the equator, which means that it's thinner up towards the poles of the Earth, the North and South Pole, and the location, the proximity towards of Denali towards the North Pole is close enough that the air is thinner. If you're at the same height on Denali as you are above sea level on Everest, Everest is closer to the equator, and you'll have more oxygen at the same level than you do on Denali.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Denali also has two peaks, and between them sits Denali Pass. And the structure of mountain here often creates a vacuum when the airstream is moving perpendicular to the pass. Air gets sucked into it and it presses it downward, and the air gets pressed down the mountain at speeds much greater than 100 miles per hour, and it is often estimated to be as high as 300 miles per hour. So the analogy that,
So how does anybody hike this?
well,
What?
very carefully. So the analogy that somebody used was like if you're squirting a hose and you want the water to come out and like spray farther and you put your thumb over the hose, that's essentially what's happening in the pass is there's not enough space for all of the air to move through the pass. And so the options are either to move the mountain, which clearly cannot happen, or the winds speed up to fit through that pass. And so the winds speed up and then gravity takes over and it just sucks it down, which is a terrible experience, I am sure.
Yeah, I'm sure no one has lived to tell about
No, I don't think so.
it.
So this effect is called the mountain effect, and that's when the wind speeds get forced to speed up due to the structure of the mountain is called the mountain effect, and I've not heard of that before. Crevices and avalanches are an all too real and common threat, and many believe that Denali creates its own weather. In addition to this, Denali often has clouds and mist surrounding it, meaning that even if you make it to the peak, you might not see anything. Generally, when climbing Denali, it is expected that you will lose weight while on the mountain, even when consuming as much as 5,000 calories per day. And also an interesting nutrition-related note, because that is also another like very passive interest of mine. If you are above 14,000 feet, consuming fats and protein or any nutrient-dense foods can cause your body to acclimate to that elevation slower.
So, is it eating carbohydrates while acclimating? Is that, does that not negatively impact your acclimation?
Yeah, like simple carbs,
Really?
because your body is spending so much energy digesting your food that it's not like properly circulating the oxygen at a rate that.
So simple carbs are just so much easier to process that that's an okay choice.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting. I think I'm gonna go hike Machu Picchu. Couple months, so that's a
Ooh.
good note.
Yeah. Eat all the carbs. We're
Wow,
giving you permission. Not
Kayla
that you really need it, but like, I don't know. There's the, you know.
I haven't hiked in a long time. I'm sure I'll want all the food.
Yeah, so eat all the carbs. As Joe Wilcox, leader of this fateful expedition, worked on getting matters around and kind of was running into some walls getting permission to climb Denali, which I'm not fully understanding because I've heard it go both ways that it used to be extremely strict with rules and requirements that you had to meet in order to get permission to climb Denali versus now, like those are a little bit more loose. But then I've also heard that it used to be way more lax than it is now, and now it's harder to get permission if you're going to be climbing by yourself. Whichever way it is. Joe was running into some trouble getting permission, and he was absolutely insistent that it happen the summer of 1967, and he was willing to do anything he could to get it done. And the book goes into way more detail about what all was going on at this time, but it's not pertinent to the actual demise of this group of men. So we're gonna just kind of glance over it real quick. Denali had some pretty meticulous requirements to obtain permission to climb the mountain, And some of these requirements looked at the climbing experience of those in the expedition, as well as the size of the group. So Joe, first thing he does is he starts looking for people to join his group. He had several people join, and then multiple people dropped out pretty quickly. So he ended up having to put a newsletter out to potential climbers offering a spot for $300 per person, which, if you go in like today's dollars, is roughly $2,000. Expeditions to climb Denali,
So for a guide.
for a guide to assist you. And I'm sure it's not just you. I think it's like a group of people. The 2024 and 2025 rates are lowest one I could find was $10,800, and the highest one I found was $12,200. So rates have increased a significant amount from what it was in the 1960s. Like everything else.
A
Of
little
course.
bit.
In the December prior to the trip, Joe sent his application to Mount McKinley National Park, which is now Denali National Park, where he proposed the climb, outlined their experience, and explained a study that some of the members were intending to perform while on the mountain. And again, the book goes into more details about like what that actually was, but there wasn't a ton of information about like the actual study. It was just, they explained a little bit more about like how the study would help fund their expedition. And at the time, the chief ranger, Art Hayes, had concerns with the Wilcox expedition being fairly young and inexperienced. And at the same time, a small group from Colorado also applied. So then the group from Colorado originally had four people. One person had to drop out, which made their expedition too small to be allowed to climb the mountain. So it was implied that in order for the Wilcox expedition to, and for the Colorado group to be able to climb, they would need to join together because the Colorado group had more experienced climbers, but the Wilcox group had the numbers of people. This is where it might get a little bit confusing. Joe was leading the team known as the Wilcox Expedition, and this ends up being made up of Joe's original group and the Colorado group. Joe's expedition included Steve Taylor, Mark McLaughlin, Jerry Clark, Ansel Schiff, Hank Janes, Dennis Lutcherhand, Walt Taylor, and John Russell. And I'm going to be, throughout the story, I'm going to refer to them as their first names. So you don't need to, don't worry about their last names. And so then the Colorado group includes Howard Snyder, who was the original like leader of the Colorado group, but then he kind of like sort of passes the torch to Joe, but at the same time, like they combined together, but they still were like kind of separate at the same time.
Okay. So he's like his right hand.
Yeah, sort of. And then Paul Schlitzer and Jerry Lewis were also in the Colorado group. There are two Jerrys.
Lewis and Clark.
I did not see that.
Perfect.
I'm gonna do my best to like make sure that when I'm talking about Jerry's that I tell you which one I'm talking about. But I will also say that if you're not sure, most of the Colorado group acts together. So if like Howard's there, Paul and Jerry are also there. Joe tends to join this group quite a bit. Sometimes Steve joins this group, but then like John and Walt and Denny and Hank in the Wilcox group tend to also stick together, kind of separate from the other ones. So there's not a whole lot of overlap with those two groups. All of these men, except for three, were in their early 20s. The three outside of this were 30 to 31, and all of these men had climbed multiple peaks of 10,000 feet or higher and had experience in cold climates where glacial travel and ice travel were necessary. So they were in consideration with their age, they were very well experienced and they were very well prepared for what they had to do, despite their age. I mean,
Right.
I'm 32 and I have no idea where to start when it comes to climbing a mountain. I would probably start by just trying, and then when I start feeling sick, I'm going to be like, all right, I'm going to go down.
Yeah, they weren't amateur.
No, they were not doing this as a hobby.
Right.
In an effort to join the groups and get some experience before arriving in Alaska, Joe arranged that the men would all meet at Mount Rainier National Park in June. And this is the gathering that ultimately led them to agreeing that the Colorado group would join the Wilcox expedition. So prior to this, they had like agreed, but they hadn't like welcomed the idea just yet.
Yeah.
On June 10th, while in Rainier, Denny pulled Joe aside and told him that he was leaving, and that he had this overwhelming feeling that there was going to be problems, specifically with the climb of Denali. And Joe kind of was like, what are you talking about? Like, tell me more. I'll hear you out. You know, we really want you on this trip. We value your experience. We value you.
Denny is from the Wilcox group.
Yes.
Okay.
So Joe ends up talking him kind of off the ledge.
Huh.
Okay.
Honey.
Okay. Sort of. Yeah, pretty much. So they have a conversation about it, and Denny ultimately decides that he's going to go forward with the expedition.
Yikes.
Then the next day, the men all loaded up their vehicles and headed for Alaska. The Colorado group all got into Jerry's truck from the Colorado group. And then the Wilcox group split up between Hank's van and Joe's carryall, which, if you don't know what a carryall looks like, it looks like the mix between a Bronco and an SUV. It's very lifted and very, like, boxy, but also, like, not, like, quite as boxy as a Bronco.
It's appropriate for this adventure.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Very. And then Joe had a trailer of gear on the back of his carryall. So when they reached the Canadian border, the Colorado group got held up because the customs agent thought it was really weird for three men to be carrying several pairs of snowshoes, and they didn't quite believe that they were going to climb Denali, especially because it was in June that they were traveling through. And so they were like, what are you talking about? Where are you going? And why do you need snowshoes in June? But also, like, that's not, like, a super suspicious
right, like,
behavior.
They seem quite nosy.
Yeah. So I think what it probably was probably more, like, curiosity than we think you're up to something. Mm. But
maybe they were bored, or
how?
Yeah, maybe that was super, that was a very strange
encounter. It might have been. I mean,
people are just more strange in general now, so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you kind of expect a little bit of different people to kind of walk through your door every day.
Right.
Once they were in Alaska, Joe's carryall popped a tire, and then the engine started to whine. A mechanic confirmed that the engine bearings were shot, and so Joe, who was hauling the trailer, asked the Colorado group to haul the trailer while the entire Wilcox group climbed into Hank's van. I'm just imagining, like, eight, nine men inside of a van. And probably the clown car that it was of them right. getting out. Like you open the door and you see, like, one,
how
two,
many hours
three,
from Canada?
Four.
Oh, wait, they're in Alaska, right?
They're in Alaska now, okay. Yes. But then, Alaska is a huge...
Yeah.
state.
I'm like, how much further do they have?
They you know what? They were dealing with it. They had goals, and they were not letting this broken down vehicle get in the way. On June 17th, they saw the mountain looming in the distance for the first time, and they all just kind of had like a moment of like, this is what we're doing. And some of them were super excited, and some of them were a little bit nervous, but like overall there was like this sense of excitement going into it. So the feelings that Denny at that time had previously kind of like really passed over him. Like he wasn't feeling nervous at all anymore,
Oh.
which maybe was good, also maybe it was bad.
If you're gonna do it, you might as well feel good about
Yes.
it.
Yes. Once in the park, the men parked their vehicles and hired Burl Mercer, who is a local rancher, to use his pack horses and carry all of their gear from Wonder Lake, which was kind of like the stopping point of the roads, and trek 18 miles to McGonnell Pass, which lays at the base of the mountain. The route they planned to take to the summit was considered the traditional route, which is what led a group to success 50 years prior. However, the Muldrow Glacier had moved significantly, which made the route longer, more difficult, and more dangerous, and almost impossible to climb.
When they did this, did they know that the route was more challenging than 50 years prior?
Yes, but I also think that it was one of the like more clearly tracked routes, and so they kind of would, it was one that multiple people had used, multiple people had climbed, so there was like leftover things kind of leading them up, and this comes into play, you know, later as they get towards the summit, there were still rods left in places for them to be able to follow and be like, oh, okay, I know that I'm on the right route.
Right.
On June 22nd, the entire group was either at the base of the mountain or on their way. Steve was already sitting in a near constant state of worry and depression, and it doesn't really talk a whole lot about why, but he was just like extremely sluggish on the hike to the base of the mountain, and he kind of lost track of the group a couple of times, and at one point he actually like completely went off the wrong on the wrong trail and then had to like circle back and get back on the right trail when he realized that he was on the wrong trail. They do say that having seen the mountain in real life, it triggered him into a terrified state. And from the beginning, outsiders were noticing and making comments. So this Burl
The rancher.
rancher guy apparently made a comment about him, but was really able to get like a confirmation about like what was really going on. They made their first camp at McGonnell Pass and then made their plans for how they were going to get up the mountain. Due to the size of their group and the supplies that were needed, this meant that on climb days, part of the group would climb up, make their next camp, and then return back down. So they, to help acclimate, it's best to climb up and then sleep at a lower elevation. So they were
Oh.
climbing up, making a camp, dropping off supplies, and then returning back down, picking up more supplies because they had such a large group that they couldn't all just carry their supplies in one shot. So they'd pick up more supplies, make their way back up to that prepared camp, and then return back down. And they would do this over and over until all of their supplies were at the next camp. And then they would break down the camp at the lower elevation and repeat the process. And so that's basically how they scaled the mountain. Once they get into like the snowy sections of the mountain, the men who were essentially breaking the trail to get to the next camp were carrying a significantly less amount of supplies. So as they were breaking the trail, that was extremely hard work. There were times where they were going through snow up to their chest. And so instead of making them super tired by carrying a ton of gear and digging through the snow, they would carry less gear, dig through the snow, and then the men who were not breaking the trail would carry larger packs.
Okay, that makes sense.
The group only had one option to go up the McGonnell Pass, and that was down the center of the pass because it sat in a valley with sharp, this was where part of the glacial walls were.
Okay.
So they had walls on each side, and their only option was to go like straight up the middle.
Would this be a danger zone for the 300 mile per hour winds?
No,
Okay.
not. I think at this point that is like it's at like a low enough elevation that the winds would subside a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But there's plenty more of the mountain to go. At the lower elevation, rain and sun were unpredictable and very common, so the men were constantly dealing with wet clothing and sleeping bags. And then as the sun peaked out, they were rushing to get all of their gear out in the sun to help dry it off, and then having to, like, bundle it all back up again because it started raining.
Man, just think of the difference from now and then in the kind of gear and the quality of gear that they make.
Yes.
I mean, not just as far as keeping your stuff dry, but then the weight.
Yes.
And the compact size of everything that they make all the gear in now. It would be, if you could bring these people back and be like, let's climb in 2024,
it would be a different experience.
Right.
Yeah.
It would be like a stroll.
They would
compared
they would be
to
like,
what they did.
We were doing what with what? Right. You guys aren't even climbing at this point.
Should have just got frozen in this mountain and came back.
Yeah. So as the pack horses brought in the last of the supplies on June 24th, Jerry, Denny, John, and Walt started their way up to what would be Camp 2, which was located at the top of McGonnell Pass. And this was at the base of the lower ice fall, elevation sitting at 6,500 feet. The ice falls are extremely dangerous because these are similar to glacial waterfalls. The ice is flexible and bends and cracks and forms extremely deep crevasses. And on their summit bid going up this route, they would have to cross 6 different crevassed ice fields. 3 of them were on this Muldrow Glacier. So they would get like through like one section and have like a bit of a break in like the quote unquote dangerous area. And then they would have to cross over another to kind of like hopscotch up this section of the mountain.
Okay.
And then there were 3 other on the Harper Glacier, which is higher up. Besides the crevasses, avalanches were another extreme danger. Crevasses can sometimes be identified. Okay, so the more probably dangerous out of crevasses and avalanches are crevasses, because sometimes you can't see them. And a lot of times, not a lot of times, but sometimes you can identify them because as you're like looking at the snow, like laying across the ground, you'll see a little bit of a dip. And that's where the crevasses underneath of it. So strap into each other so that way if somebody falls into a crevasse, there's at least the chance that he won't, you know, fall all the way to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chance that you can pull him back out. And then they also had poles that they were using to like stab into the snow and see if anything shifted, which I'm sure they got a ton of good feedback from using that method to
find. When you say poles, do you mean like ice picks?
My understanding was like more like ski poles.
Okay.
But it might have been ice picks. I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I'm sure that they all had their own method to the madness of, you know, getting safely across these glaciers. So the ways that you can get across a crevasse is to either go around, jump across them, or walk across them. So if there's snow and you see the dip there and you're like, that's probably a crevasse, I'm going to see if I can walk across it because the snow is kind of staying stable enough. To go around the crevasses, they were often hugging against slopes, which were very prone to avalanches. So they were taking themselves out of danger of one area and putting them in danger in another area. But to be fair, I think there is an immediate danger with crevasses and only a potential danger of an avalanche.
Yeah.
So you pick your poison. But because of this danger, they also pretty much only moved at night because, one, they're in Alaska and the dark hours are shorter than what we have here in Ohio in the summer. So they would have like, there's like a 4-hour window of quote unquote darkness, and it's not even like fully dark. It's just like a sunset hazy type of a thing, because they're just so far north that they're not getting all of the earth in the way of the sun and all that stuff that we don't need to discuss in this podcast. That's a whole nother thing in and of itself. But then because the night hours were colder, it made the snow more stable. And so they were at less risk of the snow collecting in the crevasses moving and avalanches occurring.
Okay.
Joe began trying to map out how to push up through the glacier and establish Camp 3. However, on June 27th, one of these options was eliminated because an avalanche came crashing down the mountain. Howard, Steve, and Jerry were the first to climb to Camp 3, and they were looped together as they were ascending the glacier. One of Howard's snowshoes had come loose, and so he stopped to adjust it as Jerry continued forward. Jerry was probing the ground in front of him and looking for crevasses when suddenly he fell. Howard quickly slammed his ice axe down into the ground, which stopped them all from falling, but Jerry had fallen down into a crevasse. Luckily, he was stopped by the rope and this held his weight, but he was dangling face down about 9 feet deep, and he said that he was able to see down into the crevasse and that it opened up to about the size of a basketball court and had deep blue walls and it looked like a black lake on the bottom.
Man, that's cool.
So he's just like dangling there. I think that would be like, once you realize that like you're not falling and you're not dying,
it'd be amazing.
It would be really cool.
It'd be amazing after the fact.
Yes. Yes. I
only
agree. Yeah. To hold the rope in place, they screwed the rope into the ice to secure it and then essentially belly crawled their way over to check on Jerry. First, they pulled his pack out, and by this point, Mark had arrived with a pulley system to help lift Jerry from the crevasse. Mark had brought skis with him, thinking that it would be easier to descend using his skis than just like hiking back down. And he was kind of given a little bit of shit for this because like some of the people were like, what the heck are you doing with skis? You're adding gear, you're adding weight.
Yeah, there's a lot of things there.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to use them. But they ended up coming in handy because they acted as an additional anchor to help pull Jerry out of the crevasse.
Huh.
So they weren't a complete waste.
Right.
Which I would be happy with. Like, good. Thank you for having those.
Yes.
Keep us all a little bit safer. I think there's also the added benefit that if you're like skiing and like essentially doing like cross-country skiing up a mountain, the skis are long enough that if you're crossing a narrow crevasse,
yeah,
the chances of you falling in are smaller. Like they're gonna act as a bridge across that space.
Right. But just like any kind of hiking in this situation on skis seems significantly dangerous. I can't imagine they actually wore skis while hiking, right?
Not enough.
Yeah. I could see if someone got injured and did it like a makeshift emergency person carrier.
Yeah.
Like that could be really useful.
Yeah.
If you had to drag someone up the mountain.
Yeah.
Lay them on skis.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, there's benefits.
Yeah.
But.
I'm trying to help Howard out here because I don't know what he was thinking taking skis
on this trip. Well.
There's every ounce counts. There's anyone who's hiked knows that.
There's a lot of questions when it came to this. But it was also the 60s. Who knew what was going on?
How long of a hike is this? Did they intend for this to be going to be?
I think they intended it for them to take about a month.
And with this kind of trek, you have to take all your food with you from the beginning and water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is so much weight.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And they make some mistakes. We're going to get there real soon.
Wow. I mean, even through hikers on the AT and PCT typically refuel every 3 to 5 days.
Yeah.
7 at the most.
Yeah. Yeah.
And once you go to repack in town, like the first day is like miserable because your pack's so heavy.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a completely different experience. I can't even imagine all the gear. How did they carry it? Did they pull it? Did they bring like a sled?
I think what they, so they basically shuttled it up and down. So they would fill their pack, go up, drop it off, take their empty pack back down, refill it, and carry it back up.
Yeah, I just can't. I cannot mentally comprehend how much food and water they had to take with them.
For 12 grown men
Well,
or
that
11.
doesn't bother me because if you just break it up, like say you went alone, you would just be like, because typically having more people is good because you can share the burden of a lot of equipment, right? So
Right.
even earlier when you talked about it, I was like, well, the more people, the more you can share equipment, which should make the load less.
Yes.
But regardless, even if I'm one person hiking, the amount of for a month, if I plan for a month of food and water.
At roughly 5,000 calories a day.
Well, can they eat the snow
They do.
and ice?
They do.
Okay, that's helpful. But once you get to a certain elevation, it's really, really hard to make fire, and then you can't melt anything.
Yeah.
So now I'm just thinking out loud.
That,
This
you know,
is wild.
it's valid thoughts. I mean, there's so much more that goes into climbing a mountain of this scale than I think like the average everyday person would think about. And that's one of the things is like, how much food and water do I need? How am I going to have access to that food and water? Am I going to be able to rely on my stove to heat enough water for me to be able to consume enough water to stay hydrated? And once you're at like certain elevations, you need more water to stay hydrated.
Right.
So like taking all of this into account, I mean, then there's also, you know, once you get to a certain elevation, you're like, okay, push to the top, get there as quickly as possible, and descend again. So there's also like that mentality, but it's just, it is mind-boggling to me, like how much stuff you need to take into consideration. And like I said, mistakes get made. And we will talk about it
Okay.
here almost next. We're very close to some of their problems. After Jerry was pulled out, they continued forward and ended up having whiteout conditions at 7,300 feet, which was just below their intended Camp 3 location. So they stored all of their gear and returned down to Camp 2. That same night, Joe accidentally spilled fuel for the stove while he was cooking dinner. And when he lit the stove, it caused the entire floor of the tent to catch on fire. Luckily, because he was right there, he was able to put it out right away and like minimal damage occurred, but that was a very high chance that you lose a tent because first off, why are you cooking inside of a tent?
Well, it might have been really cold, and there might have been wind, which makes it really hard for your fire. Just thinking outside the box, maybe it was dumb, but
But there's
also.
also carbon monoxide if you're staying inside of the tent.
Good point.
The next day, the team of Joe, Hank, John, and Denny all made their way up to Camp 3, which was located at 8,100 feet, which is still very low on the mountain, and all things considered. Because of the way glaciers are formed, even if the air temperature is below freezing, the sun radiates off all of the surfaces and can create a sunburn-like effect, including blisters, and will even sunburn inside of your nostrils, lips, top of your mouth, unless you have like protection. What do they call it? Like snow blind, where your
That's real.
eyeballs get burned and you go blind.
Yes.
Which at one point I was like, I want to climb Everest.
At this point, you're like,
And you know what?
maybe not.
I think that's not something I want to do.
One less thing on my bucket list.
Look, I would really like to not burn my eyeballs. Like,
I've heard it's terrifying, and you just have to wait. It happens on the PCT a lot.
yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, not to me. I didn't do the whole PCT.
Right, yeah.
Don't give me any of that credit, but I
No.
heard stories.
Yeah. Oh, I've heard stories too. I hope to do the PCT someday, but also not anytime soon. Not at a stage in my life where that's an achievable goal.
I think I'd like to do one of them. But I did look up the bo so because I was thinking about this because I'm not going to take my cooking stove to Peru when I hike Machu Picchu because of the elevation. So I did look it up. At 7,500 feet elevation, the boiling point of water is 198 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's really, so you would use, you'd have to bring so much gas.
Yeah.
To boil water and take food. That's almost, but isn't that amazing?
That's insane. Yeah. I had no idea. Yeah. I didn't even think. I mean, I like knew that.
I mean, why would you?
Elevation changes the boiling point of water, but it did not connect.
I never knew that until I went hiking in the Four Point Pass in Colorado. And okay. I was like, I can't get my water to boil.
Yeah.
Someone's like, you're dumb.
Oh, no.
Like, you know, you don't know till you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you don't get the experience unless you're actually doing it, right?
Well, how many people are thinking about the boiling temp of water at high elevation? I don't know why you would know that.
Yeah. I don't. Well, for a very short period of time, I lived in Colorado, so I should know that.
There you go.
But also lived there for a very short period of time, so. Because of these reflective properties, even if temperatures were at or below freezing, it still allowed the area to warm up enough that on sunny days, these guys were able to move around in just like their shorts and t-shirts and stay relatively warm. They also would lay out any of their gear that might have been wet and dried it in the sun. So while they were getting up there in elevation, they were now reaping the benefits as well. Camp 3 was the first camp that they didn't have melted water nearby, so they started having to pretty much run the stoves constantly to melt the snow for water to drink and cook with. And for a second time, there was a stove fire. John had apparently overpumped the stove, and the gas that was moving through the stove ignited one of the gaskets and caught on fire, but this one was also quickly put out. Days later, on July 4th, the men established Camp 4 at 11,000 feet, which was at the top of Muldrow Glacier. And from here, the men decided to go onto Karstens Ridge, which includes the Harper Icefall and Brown Tower. And Brown Tower is a section of granite that towers to 14,600 feet. And so it's like a landmark area. Unfortunately, as they climbed higher, they started experiencing more and more snow. And as they started to approach Karstens Ridge, they found that a recent snowstorm that had missed them where they were located had dumped snow that reached up to their shoulders. So they were really pushing through deep snow at this point.
Yeah, I can't even.
Cam and head down.
Right.
No, thanks.
Trying to envision that. I mean, they have to, like, dig it out as they walk, right?
Yes. I hope I didn't pass over this little note, so I'm going to say it here in case I don't say it later, where it makes more sense, like, where it actually happened. Some of the guys at one point started complaining about how much stuff they had and how heavy their packs were, and so they decided to get rid of a few heavier things, including shovels. So they kept, like, the blade of a shovel, but they got rid of all of the extra shovels and the handle to the shovel, as well as a ice saw that they had brought with them.
Oh.
Which absolutely plays an effect. Later, like, one of these instances, and I don't know, again, I might be skipping ahead at this point, but if they don't have their shovels to dig through snow to get up the mountain, you're wasting so much energy to push through that snow.
Yeah.
They then established Camp 5 at 12,100 feet. And this was the only camping spot available on the ridge due to the amount of snow that had been falling. And this began where they really struggled to make their way up to the next camp. And they would have to push their way through shoulder-deep snow for days and days and days before they were able to establish the next camp. And then they would turn around, go back down to the lower camp, and then, you know, shuttle their way back up, push through the snow again because there's wind, it's drifting, it's blowing over the path that they already created. And in an attempt for pushing to Camp 6, the men only made it 600 feet And then the next day, they found that the wind had been so aggressive that it completely blew over the trail that they had made. So they had to push through that same section a second time. That night, from the slopes below the ridge, the men felt the ground drop, and below them, two separate avalanches released simultaneously. So they were on the ridge and they felt the ground drop. And then on each side of that ridge, the avalanches went.
Man, the mental state at this point, they're amazing.
They're
yes, amazing.
They're amazing.
Like, at this point.
Also crazy.
Well, yeah. But they have to be so miserable and defeated.
Yeah. And starting to feel altitude sickness. And
to I shovel mean, 600 feet and then it's just like, redo.
So then they were also like, they started this on June 22nd. So they're like 3 weeks in at this point. So, I mean, they're tired, I'm sure.
They're miserable. They're tired. They're grumpy.
And
defeated. And then the two avalanche thing. That has to be terrifying.
Yeah. Whew. Oh, for sure. They finally established Camp 6, which was on the Harper Glacier at roughly 15,000 feet. And they quickly all gathered here by July 13th. It was from this camp that they were able to see the peak sitting 5 miles away from them. So now it's in sight.
Yay!
At this point, all of the men on the expedition were suffering in some way. Some had indigestion and nausea so bad that they weren't eating, and others suffered from headaches. Acute mountain sickness, or AMS, presents itself with headaches, vomiting, insomnia, dehydration, and edema. If left untreated, it can lead to high-altitude pulmonary edema, which is a fatal condition where the capillaries in your lungs are unable to handle the pressure and begin to leak into your lungs. AMS can also cause high-altitude cerebral edema, which is also fatal, and much like your lungs, the capillaries in your brain begin to leak and cause dramatic swelling in the brain. The best course of action for either of these is to descend to a lower elevation. In addition to the high altitude and strenuous activities these men were pushing themselves through, the men with Joe specifically were also inadvertently giving themselves carbon monoxide poisoning because they were cooking all of their food inside of their tents.
Well, you already knew that was going to happen.
Yes, I did.
But you were right.
But because it's a thing.
Okay, maybe there's no pros to cooking inside your tent.
I mean, if it's like one, but to be doing it for all of your meals every day after 3 to 4 weeks, find a different way.
Yeah, I feel like it's something they should have, you know,
considered.
Yes.
Have a cook tent. Cook your food in that tent and then take your food and eat it in your tent that you're going to sleep in.
Or you would have just, like, yeah, considered it before your trip and, like, been like, oh, well, we know about carbon monoxide poisoning. This is a bad idea.
We need to address it in some way.
Yeah.
Whatever that way is, whatever. They didn't pay attention. At Camp 7, which is also known as the High Camp, it was established at 18,000 feet on July 14th, and it was decided that the cook tent would be left at Camp 6, since after this, the plan was to basically get up to the summit and get back down. And they intended to do this in the same day. So 15,000 feet, get up to the 18,000 foot camp, get up to summit, and then go back down to the 15,000 foot camp is what their intentions were. And there at Camp 6, another stove mishap occurred. There are different versions of the story. However, what everyone can agree on is that Joe, Hank, Walt, Steve, John, and Denny were all inside of the tent preparing some food using two separate stoves. An explosion occurred and the tent went up in flames. All of the men lunged for the door of the tent at the same time, but by the time they got there, the tent had quote-unquote vaporized. Despite all of these little mishaps and fires, no one was injured except for some singed beards and eyebrows. And besides losing the tent, Walt lost his down parka in the fire and John lost his sleeping bag.
Aye.
On July 15th, John tried to get a weather forecast by using the radios that they were given by park headquarters, but at the time they didn't have much to go on other than the barometric pressure, which showed good weather over the next couple of days. And it was here that it was decided the summit teams would split up and attempt one day apart. The summit, at 20,320 feet in elevation, hovered before them. Not only is Denali the tallest mountain in North America, but it is arguably the largest mountain on the planet. While Everest holds claim to the tallest point above sea level, the base of the mountain also sits at a higher elevation. From base to summit, Everest juts 12,000 feet into the air, while Denali inclines 18,000 feet from base to summit. The only taller mountain in the world is Mauna Kea, which I could be pronouncing incorrectly.
It's okay, I don't think you've said Denali once.
Oh, shit. butchering names all over. This mountain's in Hawaii, and the majority of it is under the water. On July 16th, Joe, Howard, Paul, and Jerry, the first summit team, worked their way to Denali Pass, where they then made radio contact in order to confirm and communicate that they reached the summit. Eielson, the radio communication location, sat with them as the men finished their climb. The weather was beautiful, the sky was blue, and they had stripped down to their t-shirts. Around 6:30 p.m., all four were standing on the summit. The clouds were low, sitting near 11,000 feet, so they were able to see all of the other mountain peaks poking up through this veil of mist. Joe had secretly carried a Coca-Cola to the top, which he then opened and shared with the three others, and they sent off smoke bombs and took photos while in radio contact with Eielson. They sent postcards to family and loved ones, and after about 90 minutes at the peak, they made their way back down to high camp, where they decided to stay for the night before switching places with the party at Camp 6 the following day.
Wait, I'm confused about this postcard thing.
So they, while they were on in radio contact with Eielson, which was like the communication headquarters for them, they basically said, hey, send a postcard to my parents. This is what I wanted to say. And so that's what they would do, is they would write out the postcard and then mail it for them.
They throw in paper airplanes off the mountain.
Yeah, actually. Here, Mom.
Yeah. I made it.
Congregating at the high camp, they woke on the 16th to wind and snow that had returned and somehow started to contemplate throwing in the towel. So that was the second summit team.
Okay.
Was like, eh, maybe we can't do this.
They're so close.
I know.
What?
By the 17th, the weather had cleared. Joe, Howard, Paul, and Jerry descended to Camp 6, and when they started to leave, they offered anyone who wasn't feeling well to come with them. And while some showed clear signs of altitude sickness, Ansel was the only one who decided to abandon going to the summit. He had come on the expedition for the science study, so he never planned on making it to the summit to begin with. And his behavior when deciding to go down was described as, quote, he didn't just throw open the door and crawl. He exploded out of the tent and said, I'm going down with you.
Get me out of here.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Does seem kind of rational.
Yeah. At that point.
I mean, I can say in theory, no, you're so close, finish. But.
Also.
But realistically, yeah.
This behavior
I just want to get home.
Also saves his life. Spoiler.
That is a spoiler, but
it
I'm
is
not.
A spoiler.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. Any life saved. Around 1 p.m., Joe, Howard, Paul, Jerry, and Ansel made their way down to Camp 6, but the team made up of Jerry Clark, Steve, Mark, Hank, Denny, Walt, and John weren't even close to getting their way to the summit. 2 hours later, when they finally left on the roughly six-hour climb, Steve laid in the tent at 18,000 feet because he was too nauseous to move forward. Around 8:30 p.m., the radio to Eielson cracked with the voice of Jerry stating that it would take them another 45 minutes to an hour to make the summit. Then around 9:30, the radio cracked again. This time, Jerry was calling for assistance. The wands that had been placed by prior expeditions to lead the way to the summit were not clearly marked out, and the group was feeling lost. They checked in again at 11:30 with no changes. So also, real quickly, when it comes to the radio contact, the radio calls to Ilsen are recorded. So they have all of this information on official record. It's not just someone saying like, oh yeah, I had this conversation with them. As soon as the radio starts going, they turn the recordings on.
Okay.
July 18th at 11:30 a.m., so now 12 hours have passed since the last radio contact was made, Jerry's voice came through the radio to Ilsen again, this time stating that they had ended up biovacking and that they were just below the summit.
What does that mean?
They slept on the mountain.
Okay.
Not in shelter. They didn't have a tent or anything. I'm assuming that they tried to like dig into the snow a little bit for like some form of shelter, but yeah, they didn't have shelter. This group did not get as lucky as the first did on the summit. The summit was surrounded by clouds, cold, and wind. As Jerry rattled off the names of who was at the summit, one man was overlooked. John Russell was not named at the summit, nor was he named as left behind at the tents. He was noted for carrying a flag that he intended to plant at the summit, which had, I believe it was like a sweatshirt wrapped around the tip of it. As the men stood on the summit, they had no idea the monster that was coming for them. Two separate storms were moving, one a low pressure system to the northeast over the Beaufort Sea heading southwest, and the other a high pressure system developing to the southwest over the Aleutian Islands moving north. The Aleutian Islands are called the Cradle of Storms by fishermen and mariners due to the strength of storms that begin here.
Question.
Yes.
John Russell did not make the summit, or he just wasn't announced?
He was not at the summit.
He was left behind in the tents.
Also no.
I don't understand what's happening.
Neither do we.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So he left with the group to go to the summit.
Oh, so when it's like a mystery.
Yes. When they got to the summit, they named off who was there. I believe twice he names off everyone who was there. And John was not named either time.
Ah.
And there's more information to come about that.
Okay.
But we...
Just check in.
Yeah. We truly do not know what happens to him.
Okay.
Because the mountain is so big and so tall, it is not unusual to have different weather to hit different areas. And the geography of the mountain itself plays a role into what weather is experienced. Also on the mountain was the MCA group, or Mountaineering Club of Alaska, which was led by Bill Babcock and included Jeff Babcock, Leo Hannon, Grace Jansen Homan, Gail Ninehauser, Chet Hackney, John Ireton, Barney Sealer, and John Haglund. The MCA expedition was on the Muldrow Glacier pushing towards Karsten Ridge as the Wilcox expedition was attempting to summit Denali. So they were like just below Joe and his group. On the other side at 17,200 feet, the Western States expedition was waiting out weather in an attempt to make it to the summit as well. So there's currently three groups on the mountain, very close to the summit.
Okay. And Joe already summited, right?
Yes.
Even though the Wilcox group
is
close. Yeah, Joe went with the other guys.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. It was about noon when the second team of the Wilcox expedition began to descend and the others lower on the mountain started to notice a shift. First, a cloud cap had formed over the mountain, and Joe at Camp 6 at 15,000 feet noticed strong winds and there was a fourth expedition on the mountain. The A-67s noted a severe wind increase. On July 20th, now 2 days later, the wind was still howling and Joe hadn't heard from the team at high camp at all, so he decided that he was going to climb up and see how they were doing. After crossing 3/4 of a mile in 4 hours, he decided to turn back and wait out the storm. Joe began to call for a flyover to see if anyone could drop supplies to the high camp to help them weather the storm, but due to the high winds and whiteout conditions, they were unable to fly. As I mentioned earlier, the radio communications were extremely complicated during this time communicating with rescuers. Joe was able to reach Fairbanks. Fairbanks called Eelson, who called headquarters. And so they were relaying this message in a really crazy way. And sometimes that took a really long time to pin down exactly what was meaning to be said. So again, it's also like a game of telephone. Like one person says something, the next person says their version of it, and the next person says their version of it, and then the fourth person has a question, and then that question gets bounced back. By the time it gets back to the group, they might not be answering the question that had been asked.
Right.
So communication just took so long at this point. The winds were sustained around 80 miles per hour and pummeled snow onto the mountain. The MCA expedition responded by building snow walls around their tents as well as building an igloo, but the Wilcox team was just left with their tents as they had ditched their saws and shovels early in the climb. On July 21st, the wind picked up to 100 miles per hour, and at 15,000 feet, using binoculars, those on the mountains could see slabs of ice 15 to 20 feet long being picked up and blown about like kites. During the night, Joe and Ansel's tent collapsed, and with the wind, they couldn't get it up again, so all five men shoved their way inside of the four-man tent left standing. It is predicted that the wind velocity from July 20th to 22nd was increasing to upwards of 300 miles per hour as it flowed over and down the side of the ridge. After 4 days, the snow finally stopped, but the wind stayed steady. The Western States Expedition tried to run to the summit now that the snow had stopped, but as they approached, they were literally being blown off of their feet and into the air, which is terrifying.
That is terrifying, but I'm, like, reassured to hear that in the sense that as you're talking about 300 miles per hour winds, I'm like, I don't understand. Like, I'm glad they're all in one tent so they can weigh it down and not be blown away, because I feel like you would, one person in a tent would just get blown away.
The only way they made it back to their tents was by laying on their bellies and using their ice axes to crawl back. On July 22nd, the first group from the Wilcox expedition descended and joined with the MCA group. Through all of this, Joe never called for a rescue. He only called for a flyover, because if a rescue was called and not needed, they had to come out of pocket and pay for it, which is extremely expensive. I don't know that they would have been able to perform a rescue with the storm that was there. So yeah. Even if he did call and say, no, these guys need help, there might not have been anything that could have been done.
Right. I just can't imagine not calling a rescue in this situation, though.
Yeah. There's that.
Like,
I haven't heard from these guys in 4 days.
The weather is, we can't even walk.
Yeah. And I'm at the lower elevation.
Like, I'm not going to live with myself for the rest of my life unless I call a rescue.
And I think from what I've read, like, the after effects is that he does carry a ton of guilt about this, which, understandably so.
Yeah.
Especially, like,
you could be very right. They may not have been able to do anything, but
yeah.
Yeah.
That's like, I mean, a little tiny pinprick of...
Any rational human would feel really guilty.
Yes.
I think.
Oh, for sure. So the recordings and the logs make it clear that Joe was saying not to launch a rescue until an observation flight was made, which we can clearly determine that a flight and rescue was impossible due to the weather conditions. Mm. Finally, flights were made and drop packages were delivered, but there was no sign of the seven members left behind at the summit. On July 25th, after a week, the MCA team finally started to mobilize their way to the summit with the added intention of finding the seven members of the Joe Wilcox expedition and bringing them down with them. On July 27th, a flight was performed to actually observe by Alaska Rescue Group, who performed a flight the following day as well. On July 28th, as the MCA group ascended into Wilcox's high camp at 18,000 feet, John Russell's flag for the summit was found about 3/4 mile below the camp. So this is the guy who went missing.
Mm-hmm.
He left with the group. What is theorized, of course, we cannot confirm. What is theorized is that he left for the summit with the group, decided he wasn't feeling well, decided to turn around, storm hit, and he decided that he needed to go down to the lower camp to get help. And next to where his flag was a very deep crevasse. So they're theorizing that he fell and in some flail happened to stab his flag into the ground.
He could have been stabbing 4 crevasses. And
he might have. And just
somehow
he left his flag behind and there was a crevasse next to it. And so that's the logical conclusion. Or he was using it as a brace to walk and lost his footing because of the wind and
went. With those winds, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Or he said, screw it, I'm done with this shit. Stuck in the ground and jumped. Sign on.
there is that. Once arriving at high camp, the MCA group found a man sitting up and clutching a pole that had once held a tent. The tent had been torn to pieces, and silence overcame the area as they took in the details of the man dressed in orange. His face and hands were blue, green, and white, and his face was covered in snow. Based on the smell, it was clear he had frozen and thawed multiple times. The MCA group made camp as far from the corpse as they could get. The next morning, they woke and worked their way to the summit, which once they reached, they were able to see the Alaska rescue group flying over. It was then that the pilot was able to make contact with them and let them know that they could see something red on the mountain near Archdeacon's Tower, which was between the summit and Denali's Pass, which is how they came up.
Mm-hmm.
But the tower is like slightly below the path to the summit.
Okay.
Being conscious with the time and staying aware of a new approaching storm, Chet and John made their way down the hill and found yet another frozen body. He was sitting facing downhill with one leg extended and the other tucked under him. And down a little bit farther, they found a second body. This one was in pretty much in the same position, but he was leaning back a little bit more and like looking up towards the other guy in darker clothing and in a sleeping bag clutched around his shoulders. Neither had gloves or packs with them.
So this would be the third total corpse.
Yes. Okay. Only 3 bodies were ever found, and the families of those missing and presumed dead gathered in Denali to learn of their loved ones. Some pointed fingers and most mothers sobbed. Fathers questioned if their sons had come down in a different way and was at the base of the mountain or was in a hospital somewhere. And overall, the emotional capacity of those who lost their loved ones completely overrode sensibilities. An outcry for the bodies to be removed from the mountain was echoed through family members, but the ultimate truth was that it was infeasible. On August 26th, an attempt was made to recover the bodies, but they were nowhere to be found. It is speculated that Steve Taylor was the man found at the camp clutching what remained of the tent, and the remains of the 2 others were never identified. And I want to make 2 really quick notes. First, there's a theory that the men might have dug into the snow somewhere and tried to like create a snow cave.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the flatlands of Ohio, we know that when the wind is blowing and there's snow falling, the snow doesn't really collect anywhere unless there's like a drift spot. So mm-hmm. like along ditches or next to the house or like wherever the wind is blowing. On mountains, you don't really have anything stopping the snow. It's just getting blown right off the ridges,
mm-hmm.
which means all of the new loose snow is getting blown away and blown about, which leaves them the really hard compacted snow that already existed. And we know that they ditch their shovels and their axes and their saw, which makes it extremely unlikely that they dug in somewhere.
Yeah, it's going to feel like ice, right?
You're not going to get anywhere in it.
Yeah.
Andy Hall, who wrote this book and who the interview that I listened to with him, he speculates that these men probably died within hours of the storm hitting them, which, I mean, makes sense with the level of wind and the cold and exhaustion that they were already experiencing.
Right.
I can't imagine that they would have made it too far. They were probably coming down from the summit and got blown off their feet. The other thing that I want to mention is that the National Park System wanted to completely shut down the mountain and not let anybody climb it anymore after this incident. And Andy Hall's father, who was the superintendent at the time, really disliked mountaineering. He thought it was an idiotic thing to do, a really dangerous thing to do.
What?
But he pushed back so hard to keep climbing Denali open that it ended up staying.
That's interesting.
So even, I think it's proof that even if you don't agree with something because you personally don't like it, it doesn't mean that you have to support that theory.
Right.
That idea.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And I really enjoyed learning that little fact.
Yeah, I like that fact. That was educational. It's interesting.
Yeah. And thanks for providing your
ears, thoughts, listening skills.
And no, you gave some really good information and
that was super
points
super interesting. That's cool.
Yeah.
Hmm.